Apostolic history, this is part 7, I believe this is the conclusion. This is segment is taken from A World History of Christianity, edited by Adrian Hastings, who until his recent retirement was professor of theology at the University of Leeds in London. This particular essay is The Emergence of Christianity by Martin Goodman. This is from page 16. We are in the second segment called The Emergence of the Church. At any rate, it is with the crucifixion of Jesus in or around 30 CE that Christianity can be said really to have begun. There were many other charismatic teachers and healings in first century Judea, but for no other similar individual did a movement in his name spring up after his death. In the explanation of this fact lies the clue to the emergence of the church. In the Gospels, much emphasis is laid on the impact on his followers of reports about the resurrection of Jesus. And the resurrection already appears in the early creeds in the letters of St. Paul. In some ways, this is odd, for it is hard to see why Christ's resurrection should have seemed so important as evidence of a divine plan in action or as the first fruits of the harvest of the dead, 1 Corinthians 15:20. Since the possibility of various types of life after death for all was widely canvassed among first century Jews, whatever the explanation, it is certain that the earliest extant Christian texts, Paul's letters, reveal an emphasis on the mission, crucifixion, resurrection, exaltation, and lordship of Jesus rather than on his teachings. It is indeed remarkable that, in contrast to Jesus' missions to Jews alone, Paul rapidly proclaimed himself as apostle to the Gentiles. Hardly less remarkable when Paul taught his Gentile converts that conversion to Judaism would demonstrate a lack of faith in Jesus. And some of those converts took this to imply an ethical vacuum. Paul seems to have invented a morality for them rather than appealing except obliquely to the sayings of Jesus. After the crucifixion and news of the resurrection of Jesus, his followers in Judea and Galilee, led by his immediate disciples, the apostles, continued as an identifiable group. All of these followers were, by definition, Jews by birth. About the Jewish Christians of Galilee, almost nothing is known, but in the picture provided of the Jerusalem church in the New Testament, they appear as one Jewish group among many, living for the most part in peace, participating in the temple ritual and keeping the Torah in their own fashion while they awaited the second coming of Jesus as Christ, and with at the end of the present age. According to the picture painted by the author of Acts of the Apostles, writing probably sometime in the late first century, though both earlier and much later dates for the composition have been canvassed by scholars, these Jewish Christians lived as an ideal community, sharing all in common, Acts 2:46, 4:32, and 34. From outside, they appear to Paul as a group firmly administered by the three pillars of the church, Peter, James, and John, Galatians 2:9. This model of an ascetic authoritarian community would not have been out of place in the first century Judea, where both the Essenes and the Dead Sea sectarians, if these are not to be identified with one another, lived within similar communal structures. The beliefs of these Jewish Christians about Jesus cannot now be discovered with any certainty, since nothing known to have been written by them survived. They may have seen Jesus simply as their teachers, whose words continue to resonate after his death, just as the sayings of the teacher of righteousness were preserved by the Dead Sea sect. But in any case, for the future of the church was not to lie with such people. For the number of Jewish Christians in the Jewish homeland seem always to have been quite small. The great expansion of Christianity was to occur outside Judea. The Acts of the Apostles provided a detailed account of the missionary journeys of Paul and his circle in the first generation of Christians after the death of Jesus. The narrative may have been partially distorted by the author's hindsight and his desire to demonstrate the essential unity of the church and the compatibility of Christianity with the culture of the Roman Empire. And there are differences from what the account given by Paul of his own career and his own letters written at the time and soon after. But the main outlines of the story may be accepted. Paul and others traveled the cities cities of the Mediterranean world, such as Antioch, Ephesus, and Corinth, preaching enthusiastically a new and dramatic message that the future of all mankind had been changed by the life and resurrection of Jesus. Most of the places visited were coastal towns, but in Turkey, Paul and Barnabas penetrated into Galatia on the upland plateau, and early on, the Christian message reached Rome. The intensive missionary activity of Paul was, so far as it's known, unique in the ancient world. Mission was unknown in ancient polytheism, and although Jews welcomed outsiders who chose to become proselytes, there is little reason to suspect an active proselytizing movement in this period. By contrast, Paul marked his success by the number of converts he won. It is, of course, possible to explain his enthusiasm as a reaction to the specific injunctions of Jesus, as recorded, for instance, in Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go and teach all nations, baptizing them and bringing them instruction. But this can provide only a partial answer, since not all Jesus' alleged sayings have been followed with equal enthusiasm by Christians of all periods. And in any case, this injunction, which sits uneasily with Jesus' own career as a teacher of Jews alone, does not seem to have been taken to heart by the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, as they are described in the Acts of the Apostles. One sociological explanation, itself only an inspired guess, may provide a partial clue. It has been observed that groups disappointed in their expectations of some dramatic event often react to disappointment, cognitive dissonance, by intense activity to demonstrate the truth of the beliefs which seem to be under threat, and that Christians awaiting a dramatic but constantly delayed second coming of Christ may have been such a group. In any case, it is important to note that the missionary urge of the first generation did not continue indefinitely into the late history of the church. Who were these new Christians in this first generation of the church outside the land of Israel? Some were Jews, but many, probably most, were not. Hostile outsiders describe them as the dregs of society, and particularly women and slaves. But the social backgrounds of converts were, in fact, quite broad. Some new Christians were well-educated and had far-flung contacts, all spoke Greek and belonged to the wider culture of the Eastern Mediterranean world. Most will have had little or no contact with the native Jewish Christians of the Holy Land. But the Greek-speaking Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, the Hellenists, such as Stephen, whose martyrdom in 35 C is recorded in Acts 7 and 8, had presumably come from the diaspora either before or after their conversion. So much can be culled from the New Testament text, but they say less about the reason for converts having desired to become Christians. Jews who joined the Christian community did so presumably in expectation that they would be well placed for the fulfillment of the messianic hope. But for non-Jews, the Christian message was not easily understood. A surprising amount of extant Christian exhortatory literature from this period describes the fulfillment of prophecies, which will have been previously unknown to their Gentile audience, or promises of an afterlife, despite the fact that pagans generally lack concern about the whole topic. Many Gentile converts must have been attracted by the sheer novelty and exoticism of Christian communities. Becoming a Christian involved, at least in theory, a dramatic social shift, since if the convert followed the instruction of Paul and other Christian teachers, he or she was required to exclude himself or herself from the normal social life of the community and even the family by refusing to participate in the pagan culture which permeated nearly all activities. By contrast, the new Christian communities provide social support, mutual aid, and comfort from others whose own social identity also derived entirely from their Christian identity. It is likely that converts were encouraged rather than discouraged by stories of martyrdom, and knowledge that some had believed the Christian message to be of sufficient importance to be worth dying for strengthened those who were compelled to suffer lesser problems for their faith. At the same time, Christian toleration of mixed marriages in the hope of eventual conversion of the non-Christian partner made the social break more bearable for some. Suffering, though rarely to the point of martyrdom, was integral to the early church. Those who underwent suffering naturally tended to explain it all in theological terms, they suffered for Christ's sake, but the type and severity of suffering and the motivation of the persecutors varied widely. It has already been argued that Jesus was crucified, probably on political grounds, as a threat to the good order of Jerusalem. The execution was carried out by the Roman governor with clear support of the Jewish ruling class. Few of Jesus' followers were perceived as a similar threat. The Jewish historian Josephus recounts the martyrdom of James, the brother of Jesus, at the hands of a later high priest, Ananias, in 62. But for the most part, the Jerusalem church was allowed to increase in peace down to the outbreak of the Jewish revolt against Rome in 66. When, at least according to later Christian tradition, the Christians abandoned the city for refuge in Transjordan. But the fact that most Christians were not killed by Jews does not imply a wholly happy relationship between them. It is simply not known why Christians were thrown out of Jewish synagogues. But it is possible that it was because of their theological claims about the status of Jesus rather than because of their behavior, at least according to Acts 6:13-14. It was for his theological assertions about the temple and the Torah that Stephen was accused and eventually stoned to death by a mob in Jerusalem. Theologically based hostility may also account in part for the refusal of Jews in the diaspora to accept the message preached to them by Paul. But only a political motive can explain the decision of a synagogue authorities to subject Paul to extensive beatings as formal punishment. Paul, as a Roman citizen, could have brought his punishers into deep trouble by appealing to the Roman authorities to intervene, and it might have been thought easier simply to ignore Paul's speeches altogether rather than seek to persecute him. If Paul could not be ignored by diaspora Jews, this was probably because he portrayed himself to the Gentile authorities as a Jew. As such, he was dangerous. If the city authorities believed that the local Jews allowed one of their numbers to go from city to city, openly urging ordinary Gentiles to give up their ancestral worship on which, in their view, social stability depended, then the privileged position of the Jewish community as a protected minority could all too easily vanish. It was a sign of Paul's universalism that, despite his mission as apostle to the Gentiles, he would not renounce his Jewish status, of which indeed he was most proud. Now, that's an opinion because Paul himself said he counted all his pedigree dung, aside from the excellent knowledge of Jesus. So this is the author's view. By the end of the New Testament, period opposition to the church by Jews was already less important than that by Gentiles. In theological terms, the pagan objection to Christianity was less for what Christians did than for what they did not do. The refusal of Gentile Christians to worship the ancestral gods was seen as both wicked and dangerous to society as a whole. Objections were increased by the fact in the early years of the church that all Gentile Christians had opted out of traditional religion, unlike Jews, who were also treated with suspicion for their refusal to worship other gods. Christians did not have the excuse that they were born into people for whom this was itself traditional. Hence, Nero, after the great fire in Rome in 64, could capitalize on popular suspicion to portray Christians as responsible for the disaster. Rumors that Christians indulged in vile practices such as cannibalism and orgies became widespread in the second century, in part as a result of Christian secrecy. But the worst calumnies are not attested until the middle of the century, and in his letter to the governor Pliny, who had asked advice about the best way to deal with Christians in the countryside in Pontus and Bithynia, in modern Turkey, in circa 110, the Emperor Trajan revealed that at least some representatives of the Roman state paid no heed to such rumors. Trajan advised Pliny that Christians were not to be hunted out and that when they were discovered, they were to be set free unpunished, whatever their previous behavior, so long as they now prepared to make a sacrifice to the gods. Christians reacted to this ambiguous attitude of the state with ambiguity of their own. Some, like the authors of Acts, denied any conflict between the ends of the church and those of Rome, portraying a Roman governor as sympathizer of Christians. Otherwise, like the author of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament reveled in the idea that the scarlet whore of Babylon would eventually return demise. By the time of Hadrian, Emperor 117-137 CE, early Christian literature revealed that Christians were to be found in cities in Greece, Asia Minor, and Syria, and in Rome. Pagan texts recorded a Christian presence in the countryside of Pontus, and the discovery of Christian texts of the second century in the Egyptian countryside points to the existence of communities there also. A movement that spread so fast without strong central control was bound to take on varied hues in different places. Already, the letters of St. Paul revealed widely diverse views among Christians about the precise behavior and ideas required of them. Such variety was treated by church historians in later antiquity, such as Eusebius, as the product of the implantation of heretical error into the originally pristine church. More recent scholarship has argued, on the contrary, that an instance on uniformity of belief and practice emerged only in the second century, and that the first Christians were tolerant of great diversity. The truth, probably lies between these two extremes. On the one hand, early Christian documents portray those in the faith as belonging in effect to a third race different from Jews or Gentiles, and the epistles of St. Paul to various Christian communities show his attempt to impose some uniformity and discipline on all his brothers in the faith. On the other hand, the same letters reveal the difficulties he encountered in achieving precisely the same, and his failures and the survival of evidence from the second century of Gnostic Gospels and other literature with messages widely at variance with the Christianity endorsed in the New Testament encouraged the view that the canonization of the New Testament itself was prompted by the need to define orthodoxy and expel heresy. Thus, despite the coexistence and practice of varied forms of Christianity, the attempted authoritarianism of the early church was far more severe than was customarily to be found either in ancient paganism or in Judaism, although it was not wholly without precedent. Both pagans and Jews were generally inclined to allow wide latitude in beliefs. Precision mattered only in the minutiae of cult practice, so that it mattered less what worshipers thought while they lived their daily lives than how they petitioned the divine on behalf of the community. In contrast, as soon as the apostolic age, characterized by the leadership of charismatic preachers, reached its end in circa 75, Christian communities characteristically entrusted their offices to a single overseer, episkopos in Greek, or bishop, with quasi-monarchical powers. Communal rules like the Didache were composed to instruct Christian novice Christians in correct behavior. Furthermore, the nascent desire of some Christians for uniformity of belief and practice, already evident in the so-called Council of Jerusalem in circa 50 described in Acts, when the leaders of the Gentile mission came to a mutually satisfactory agreement with the Jewish Christians of Jerusalem on Christian teaching to Gentiles, was strengthened by a system of letter writing which tried, with only partial success, to ensure communal discipline over an extraordinarily wide geographical area. Though after the martyrdom of James the Just in circa 62, no single figure of authority for the whole church emerged. On the pagan side, the closest parallels to such authoritarian attitudes towards communities were to be found in the philosophical schools, whose leaders went to great lengths to weed out wrong beliefs. On the Jewish side, the most similar organization was a community which produced the sectarian documents found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, with their insistence on the teachings of the Teacher of Righteousness and the prescription of penalties for infringement of numerous communal rules. But neither the pagan nor the Jewish parallels to early Christian communities are exact. By the time of Hadrian, most Christians were born into the faith rather than converts, and most lived within well-established communities with their own rules and systems of mutual support. The ethics by which they lived were in part derived from traditions inherited from the teachings of Jesus and the earliest apostles. But apart from the few Jewish Christians who still followed the Torah, most lived by the ethical norms standard in the rest of Roman society. In the nature of things, the exceptional ethical stances were what most people noticed. Christians espoused an unusually rigorous attitude towards sex, praising asceticism, and strongly opposing homosexuality and extramarital fornication, abortion, and infanticide, while the fierce Christian disapproval of divorce was unique. Christian worship differed markedly from standard forms of worship in the surrounding society because of the lack of temples, altars, and sacrifices to express devotion to their divinity. The parallel with Jewish synagogues as places for reading and interpreting the Torah is not exact, since all Jews recognized the importance of sacrifice in the Jerusalem temple, in addition to synagogue liturgy. But it's clear that some of the liturgy of the early church developed out of synagogue practices with, for instance, a new Christian significance given by Paul to the Passover feast. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. 1 Corinthians 5, 7 and 8. Christians early developed the custom of regular meetings, probably on Sundays, to mark the distinction from the Jewish Sabbath. These meetings were occasions for teaching. Jewish Christians may have followed in some way the pattern of readings from the Hebrew Bible or its Greek translation, normal among Jews. Gentile Christians probably did not, but for all in the church, this was the main context in which the gospel stories about Jesus and his teachings were transmitted. Already in the first generations, Christians also evolved rites for public worship, such as the symbolic transfer onto the individual of the spirit of the divine by the laying on of hands, and baptism with water to signify forgiveness of sins, as well as entry into the assembly of Christ. The advent of the Spirit could be recognized in some by their ecstatic utterances before their fellow worshipers, taken as important evidence of the workings of the divine, 1 Corinthians 12, 28. Even if not all Christians behaved in this way, in the regular weekly gatherings, the central act of worship already assumed in many places in the New Testament was the Eucharist, a ritual breaking of bread and drinking of the cup of wine in memory of Jesus, intended both to express joyful thanks and to bring celebrants into a sacramental communion with their Lord. As with the rest of Christian life, attempts were made by some Christians to impose uniformity upon this liturgy, 1 Clement 42, with a partial success. But beyond such communal worship, individual dedication to the faith could be shown above all by regular fasts, a technique shared with other Jewish groups, and more novel, by abstention from sexual relations. There is still much debate as to how settled these forms of Christian life had become by the time of Hadrian. In almost every aspect, it is possible to find some individuals who defined themselves as Christian and yet conducted themselves differently. This was not simply a matter of wide geographical dispersal. Although this was an important factor, widely differing types of Christians lived alongside each other even in longer established communities. Thus, in Rome at the end of the first century, the attitude of the conservative Clement, with his desire for harmony and order within the church and society, contrasts markedly with the eschatological speculation of the Shepherd of Hermas, a work whose claim, viz. 2:4-3, to have been written by a contemporary of Clement, is probably to be accepted, despite a tradition in antiquity that it was not produced until the mid-second century. In Asia Minor, Cerinthus seems to have held in C-100 Common Era that the world was not created by the Supreme God. It was said that John, the disciple of the Lord, ran out of the bathhouse at Ephesus on learning that Cerinthus was there, in fear that the building might collapse on the enemy of truth, Eusebius 3:28-6. And the sober defense of orthodoxy and social order by Polycarp, Bishop of Smyrna and the most significant Christian leader in Asia Minor in the mid-second century, contrasts markedly with the wild apocalyptic imaginings of the author of the Book of Revelation. This variety is reflected in the lack of any clear consensus on the relationship required between Christian worshipers and Christ himself. Thus, in the Synoptic Gospel, Jesus was portrayed as a prophet and teacher, as well as Messiah, but also as the Son of God, While Paul described him at times as Lord, at times as the personification of the wisdom of God, 1 Corinthians 1:24, the author of Hebrews portrays him as the effulgence of God's splendor, Hebrews 1, 2, and 3, and the author of the Gospel of John saw him as the Word of God, John 1, 1, and 3. From the perspective of the pagan outsider Pliny, Epiphanius 1096, Christians simply worship Christ as God, and the docetic doctrine that the humanity of Christ had never been real because it would have detracted from his divinity is attested and opposed in the New Testament. That is in 1 John 4, 1 and 3. It is not in doubt that there was a general move among Christians in this period toward the apotheosis of Jesus. What remains uncertain is the speed of this process. In any case, learned theological debates about such matters lay in the future. In the first century of Christianity, the main focus of the church rested still in hope. Hope for eternal life for the individual and for salvation for all, when in the fullness of time, Christ would come again in glory and the world would end. In the meantime, those in Christ saw themselves as part of a people in exile, presenting themselves as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God. Romans 12, 1. Thank you very much. This is the conclusion of this particular series. Thank you for joining me. There is so much more to be said, as it says in the Holy Gospels, and the works that Jesus did at that time would consume and be written. And if all the books in the world were written, they still wouldn't cover what he's doing, because it is done by the Holy Spirit. God bless. Goodbye.